Hello, and welcome to Irreverent Testimony, brought to you by Netroots Radio, the political podcast by and for millennial and Gen Xer types from a left-wing perspective. It is Saturday, November 25th, 2007. All right, hold on. I'm getting a horrible echo now.
Yes.
I'm really getting frustrated here.
Okay.
Can everybody hear me still?
I can.
Yep. Yep, I can.
Great. Okay, let's try that again.
Okay.
In 3, 2, 1. Hello, and welcome to Irreverent Testimony, brought to you by Netroots Radio, the political podcast by and for millennial and Gen Xer types from a left-wing perspective. It is Saturday, November 25th, 2017. Happy Thanksgiving. Hope everybody is enjoying your holiday or time off, if you have it. And we have some special guests today with us. As usual, I'm Travis.
I'm Rachel.
And we have Sarah Burris of RawStory.com on with us again, and our friend Molly, frequent contributor, are back, and welcome, guys.
Happy Thanksgiving!
Happy Thanksgiving, everyone.
Yes, you too. So, hi, ladies.
Hi. Hi, Rachel.
My, what a week.
Yeah, okay.
I can't wait to talk about the news.
Yeah. All right, let's just do it. The Me Too thing. Okay.
Okay.
We've been covering it pretty extensively over here, and boy, am I exhausted. And sort of a walking ball of anxiety and triggered as fuck, and just it's just been a nightmare. How do you guys feel?
Same.
Same. I think that I think it's been a hard time for a lot of us to sort of reckon with our own stuff, and it's bringing up a lot. And, you know, I've had to temper my exposure to it quite a bit just to keep myself sane.
Yeah.
So I think that I want to just honor and recognize that a lot of us women, I think, are going through some similar experiences.
Yeah. For sure.
I want to say that, I mean, the Me Too campaign came the week after the Roy Moore stuff happened. So this has been two constant weeks of conversations about child molestation, sexual assault, sexual violence and misconduct. And what happened at our office is that one of our younger staffers went to our boss and said, I can't do that. I can't write about these stories. I'm getting triggered. This is a real problem for me. So that took her out of commission for those stories, which is fine. She's a great writer and can totally cover any topic, and she's good on assignments. When my boss called to tell me that, to tell me not to assign her those stories, my boss said, I'm going to sit out today as well because I am getting triggered. I was molested whenever I was 6 years old.
Wow.
And so now I'm like, there are two women left on the staff, you know,
yeah.
And I have such a hard time with empathy. Like I over empathize where I can feel, you know, my colleague's pain. And it's like,
yeah,
this is really hard. And I kind of have to try and shut myself off to be able to just do the job every day. And, you know, I don't know that our male colleagues fully understand what those of us are facing. And it hasn't been a topic of conversation, you know, among the staff. It has with the ladies. Like, we've been talking about it amongst ourselves, but, you know, this has been several weeks now where I can't with this stuff anymore. It's too much. And honestly, to be clear, that when it comes to traffic on our website, people don't want to read about it either. I mean, we reached a saturation level on Friday, last Friday, with the Moore stuff, where it didn't matter what we were writing about Roy Moore. Nobody wanted to click on it anymore. And the same thing happened with Harvey Weinstein, where, you know, we had been covering Harvey Weinstein for a week, and people just were like, you know, they weren't clicking on it anymore. And so we just started thinking, all right, people don't want to read this. It's oversaturated. We can't handle this. People need something. They need stories where somebody wins, you know, some justice is served somewhere.
Right.
And that has been the saving grace as those stories.
Yeah.
We were worried about that. We thought that might take a bit longer, though.
I don't know. I feel, I don't know if this is the reason, but I certainly, like, hit a point where I was like, I can't read this anymore. I can't do it because it's like, let's just relive every awful thing that's ever happened to you that you've tried to not think about. And you know, as a woman, you sort of just have to push shit away to survive. And this has been, you know, like a fresh new hell every day. It's just like, just getting punched in the face over and over again. And, I don't know.
Yeah. I found myself getting, you know, irrationally angry about it. And I think that, you know, I think I've reached that saturation point where I've really been struggling with what to say and my own stories and do they even matter and what is the point? Mm-hmm. And, you know, so, you know, there's some, you know, it's all politicized anyway. And I've spent so much time just moving on with my life, to have it constantly re-brought up is just is really tough. And I'll say the Roy Moore thing was the hardest for me, of all of the stories that have come out and all of the, you know, awful reality that we live in this toxic masculine patriarchal society. I think that the Roy Moore thing was especially difficult for me because you know, it is so politicized and people are arguing about the, you know, whether or not he's going to be tanked in the election and just glossing over what horrible things he did. And, you know, and I know that that is the nature of our news cycle. But it's particularly frustrating to see these brave and courageous women who have told a story that they've kept for many, many years, like all of us, like many of us have kept in their, you know, in their secret glove box for all these years, come out and bravely tell their story and just have it turned into a political football.
Yeah.
It's exhausting.
It is. I agree.
You know, a big part of like what I have to do on Friday nights is we have to cover what's going on all the cable news shows. And CNN took Friday off basically, and they ran their 1980s series thing. So that meant that I got to watch Fox News last night night long.
Oh my God.
And it was just unreal. I forget, you know, sometimes how it's a different world. And sure enough, I mean, they were not focused on Roy Moore. They were furious. They were up in arms about sexual harassment and sexual misconduct. And they were, you know, talking about the absurdity of all of these elected officials who get away with it. But the people they were talking about were not the president. They were talking about Al Franken.
Right.
They weren't talking just about, like, Roger Ailes or Eric Bolling or Bill O'Reilly.
It was all Al Franken. And I was just like, are you kidding me? And I guess it was last week maybe that Bill Maher made the comment where he was like, how dare you compare, you know, Al Franken grabbing somebody's butt to someone molesting a child, to someone sexually assaulting somebody. He's like, what Al Franken did was not cool. It's not acceptable. It's not cool. You cannot put that in the same category as the misuse and abuse of a child. And that just, I was so furious watching TV last night.
Well,
yep.
That's something I've really struggled with too on a couple of different notes. Because I don't want to take away anybody's pain or minimize how people have been hurt and abused and humiliated and degraded. But I agree that we also can't make false equivalences. And I'm going to be honest, there's some of these stories that I've found myself sort of rolling my eyes about. And I feel like fucking traitor to my gender and my feminism, but I have gone through so it's just like, that's what life is. That's just how life works. And some of the things people have said, it's like, okay, Jesus Christ. If every time that happened to me, I mean, I don't know. That, you know what I mean? If every time that happened to me, I said something, Jesus Christ, like my life would be nothing else. And then I feel like an asshole. I feel like a really shitty, bad person for thinking that. But I've had a lot of, like, I don't know, I've been really struggling with this, like, all of it. But that's my truth.
Yeah.
It's the same. There are a lot of women out there who have experienced things, but they have not been the degree to which, you know, it was rape or it was child molestation or something like that. And so a lot of women have stories. They're just not that, you know, that severe or that violent.
Right.
And it's really hard because you want to be supportive of your sisters, but it's you have to put things in context, and you have to put, there are degrees. That's why there are degrees in law,
right?
You know, of severity.
But I also think the reaction has been that way because we've been so accustomed to it. It's been acceptable in some way for so long. My entire life, generations of women have gone through this and worse. And there's a part of me that wants to be outraged by every single time any man did anything to anyone that wasn't good. But I find it hard. And I think that I'm struggling with the idea that I've become numb to the abuse that women endure day in and day out. And I hear some of these stories and I'm like, yeah, yeah, that happened to me too. Like, of course. Oh, that happens all the time.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? But
yep,
I don't want to be numb to it.
And I think it, you know, it does... it does risk, and you know, I think talking about the oversaturation point, I do think we're at a precipice where this could turn, and that's my fear, is that you know, it's going to become one more social justice issue that people get exhausted about, and then there's a backlash, and women are in the exact same position that they were, only now they're exposed because they've told their stories that now not only don't matter, but are actually being actively used against them. And I, you know, and I just, I it's some of the Al Franken stuff just smacks of whataboutism. And it's frustrating because women are brave and they are telling their stories. But my whole thing has been, to what end? You know, I'm not going to bare my soul if I don't think that there's some purpose to it. If it contributes to some important dialogue that's going to move us forward, what's the point? I don't, you know, maybe I'm just not as brave, but I don't want to put myself out there and tell my stories if it's just going to become one more thing that people use to bash me with.
Same. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Yep. That's the struggle.
So, yep.
And I also have this feeling of, like, who cares? Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. Is your point? Like, to what end? You know,
I want action now. Like, we've had these moments, and now it's just like, okay, well, what are we going to do about it? How do we stop this? How do we make it something that is definitely unacceptable? And for the love of God, a disqualifier for the U.S. Senate.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the presidency. But that doesn't matter.
People are all up in arms about this, Roy Moore. Oh, he's going to get elected and da-da-da. And I'm like, look, the voters have already showed. Exactly. We have a president of the United States is a rapist. So I don't think that's surprising. It doesn't surprise me at all that they're going to elect Roy Moore. They're not going to vote for a Democrat. He doesn't matter what he did. It doesn't matter. Right. And they can justify and clarify and say whatever they want. And I doesn't surprise me. We elected a literal rapist to the presidency. So I'm not surprised that he's going to win. I have no hope that he won't. And what does that say about us? I don't know. And I think that ship sailed on November 8th of last year.
That's right. And that's where I really, I find myself getting really angry, because I'm like, all these people are, you know, caring all of a sudden. And it's just you, and no one is talking about the fact that Donald Trump is an accused rapist. He's an accused child predator.
Yes.
He has engaged in some of the most horrible, despicable behavior that we've ever seen. He's a pig of a man, and he's sitting in the presidency. And yet we're talking about these piddly little, not piddly, but they're non impactful. You have a literal rapist sitting at the head of the most powerful nation in the world, and everyone is sitting here saying, "Oh, but you know."
But Al Franken
grabbed someone's butt some one time. It's so irrelevant, honestly.
That's frustrating.
You know, if you're not going to do anything about the head of the country, then stop talking about it. It's just getting frustrating now.
Yeah, I started out this whole thing feeling like, oh my God, like empowered sort of when it really first started. And I was like, okay, this feels like a sea change. This feels like a moment, like somebody might finally fucking give a shit about the things that we endure every goddamn day. And now I just feel tired. I feel exhausted. Yep. And I feel I'm anxious and I'm triggered. I just feel awful all the time now. And I don't know. I'm with you. If we could do something about it, if we could make this conversation become something more than just further exploiting women who've already been exploited for clickbait, maybe then that would be great. And I'd love to see that happen. But I don't know how to do that.
The saving grace is that both The Guardian and Politico did stories about the absurd number of women who are now running for office. And it's not something that happened because of Roy Moore, and it's not something that's happened because of this most recent thing. It happened after Donald Trump. The second that Donald Trump was elected, women all across the country, progressive women, were inspired to take to the streets. And now they are taking that protest and turning it into action. And it's not just federal offices, governorships, or mayor's office. These are women who are running for school board and state legislatures and some of the most important parts of our country that the Koch brothers have fought to take over. And we saw what happened in Virginia, you know? And that gives me a lot of hope that if more women are in office, then perhaps this will calm itself. Perhaps the waters will be a little bit calmer. I know that there are cases of women, you know, doing the exact same thing that men have done, maybe not rape, but sexual harassment for sure, because it happened to a friend of mine. But at the same time, it's not, you don't hear about, there are not as many women who are doing this as men. And I think it's because so many women experience this.
Right. And the power structure just isn't the
same.
That's
right.
I mean, the structural way that we have the world set up isn't set up for that. And I, you know, you're right. You're right about the women running, and I love them and I'm proud of them and I wish more and more would happen. And I've always said that there's a funny thing that happens when there's a group of people and there are no women, is that almost without exception, you find sexual abuse. Whether it be the Catholic Church or Penn State, you know, program or the Boy Scouts.
Oh, Sandusky, yeah.
Right. I mean, anytime there is an isolated group of men in power with no women allowed, there just is sexual abuse that happens. And when you shed, you know, light on it and you let women in and there starts to be some kind of accountability, it's lessened in some way, I think. And so maybe getting women into the halls of power will help. I hope.
One of the things I want to give props to is several years ago, a friend of mine, my dear friend in college, was killed by her boyfriend.
Jesus.
And her parents, in wake of that, founded an organization that they named after her called the Jana Campaign. And the big part of what they have been doing very, very quietly, totally under the radar, is they've been going into high schools and middle schools and talking to children about what domestic violence is. Mm-hmm. They've been talking about sexual assault. They've been talking about consent. And her dad, Jana's dad, specifically has been talking to football teams, high school football teams, even some college and NFL teams. He's been speaking to them about consent, about violence. And I honestly believe if we start having these conversations very, very young in children's lives, you get sort of this this two-way thing where you're not only helping children understand in an age-appropriate way that this is not okay, but you're also flagging it for children. So if they're seeing it in the home, maybe they might tell somebody.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I was having an interesting conversation with a male friend of mine the other day over text message. And I was, you know, talking about some of my exhaustion around the Me Too campaign, not the campaign itself, but just the, you know, being triggered. Mm-hmm. And what he said is that this is a conversation that men need to have with each other. Right. And it struck me very interestingly, parallel to when we talk about racism.
Yes.
And that Black people don't carry the burden of having this conversation, that white people carry it. And it feels very much like that same type of thing that, you know, women have told their truth. They've told what their experience is. And there's part of me that wants to just say, okay, men, now it's your turn.
Yep.
You all take this on. You talk to each other and you fix this, because God, it's not on us.
If we could have fixed it, don't you think we would have done it already?
Yeah.
In what fucking universe, if we could have done something about this, would we not have done it?
Right. And I think that's a big reason that President Obama started the It's On Us campaign.
Yeah.
You know, he wanted to go into colleges and teach men that sexual assault on campuses is not okay, and that what consent was. It's the same philosophy that Jana's campaign was doing. They're just doing it at the college level.
Yeah, and there's another campaign that I read about called it's the Man Box. It's another male to male education program that reaches out to you know, boys in high school and men in college, talking specifically about toxic masculinity and how men have been trapped into thinking that, you know, this is the only way to be a true man.
Right.
And what else is possible if it's not just that being a man is this, you know, this toxicity, what else can you be? What else is out mm-hmm. there for you?
That's interesting. Our friend Jermaine is a part of something like that as well. He was telling me that. Yeah, I don't remember what his organization is called. Do you remember, Molly?
I don't remember, but I remember us talking about it.
Yeah. And the same kind of thing. Like, there's a different path to be a good man, and it's not necessarily about toxic masculinity and being a pickup artist and all of that garbage that is sometimes fed to young men. I think those things are vital. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's, you know, parent education too, mm-hmm. you know, that, it, you know, when you reinforce that boys don't cry and that, mm-hmm. you know, all the only acceptable response to emotional, you know, to feeling bad is anger.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if we start shifting that even amongst parents and they start recognizing that in themselves, I mean, I can think of times where even I've done that, where, you know, I've assumed that boys act a certain way, or I've assumed that girls act a certain way. And, you know, it's so ingrained in us. And mm-hmm. so I think mm-hmm. those are the conversations that if this actually becomes something useful and worthwhile, those are the conversations that will start happening in our society.
Yeah, for sure.
I hope so. I was at Thanksgiving and I was talking to my older brother, and I didn't want to talk to my dad about it because I just can't. Like, I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear about how Roy Moore's not really that bad of a guy. But what struck me was my older brother, you know, he's a reasonable guy. He's got some ideas about gender that I don't really agree with, but he's not a, you know, conservative monster or something, right? And I always say, as Josh votes, as votes the nation, pretty much, because he's kind of that not really that political of a guy and kind of independent because he doesn't know much. Anyway, what struck me was he said, but Rach, it's just too much. Don't you think some of these women are lying? Like, some of them have to be lying, right? It can't be all of them. And it was like, no,
wow.
No, I don't. I don't. And I can you imagine? I said, do you want to know how many times this kind of thing has happened to me? Do you want to hear the things that have happened in my life? Because if I've never told you, maybe you don't understand that this is not something that happens to just some people. And I promise you, if you go and talk to your live-in girlfriend and you asked her, she would tell you the same thing. This
mm-hmm.
is not those women. This is all of us. This is all the women, you know. All of us.
And if it's not us, then it's your something has happened to your mom, or something has happened to your sister, or somebody
all
that you know.
All of them. I don't not I, know a woman who doesn't have a story. I don't.
No, me either. I mean, I think it's just, it seems practically impossible to reach our age and not have at least one instance of, you know, just feeling icky or not sure if I'm safe, not sure if I'm going to make it out of this, you know, mm-hmm. What do I do? You know, one of the best articles I read, about the Harvey Weinstein or however the fuck you say his name, was talking about, you know, people criticizing, well, these women, they could have left, they could have, mm-hmm. you know, done all these things. Mm-hmm. And that was this article really laying out the thought process of women when they are in these situations. And it was so Mm-hmm. It was so personal, you know, yeah. because I can't even tell you how many times, and I'm sure I know I'm not alone, how many times I've had to weigh the options.
Absolutely.
And how many, you know, what I remember from that article was she talked about you, if the choice is survival or pride, you will choose survival every time.
Yep.
And absolutely. And just understand that is the psychology of women, that we act, you know, that consent can look like that because we, you know, we don't want to talk about our fear. We don't want to, you know, what is our choice in that situation when you right. have someone who could, you don't know if they're going to snap. You don't know
no.
if they're going to.
Yeah. If I say no, what happens next?
That's
if
right.
I'm not pretty fucking sure that I know I'm safe to say no, I might not.
That's right.
Because mm-hmm. as we know, just from interactions on the street, you know, you get catcalled and you snap back and you say some shit, it turns to rage really fucking fast.
Oh, I have a great story about that. Actually, just this past week, I had parked at a downtown, a meter in downtown Denver because I was doing the meter dance during the day while I was working. Mm-hmm. I parked at a meter and this guy came up to me and I thought he was asking for a quarter, but he apparently was trying to give me money for the meter. And I politely said, no, thank you. And he started screaming at me mm-hmm. and raging at me and tried to follow me to work. I
Jesus
had to like
Christ.
Take a different path around. And this is not unusual. This happens quite frequently.
Yeah.
And it was like, and it's these instances where these things happen where I'm like, it's so normalized that I hardly even notice.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then these stories all start coming out and I'm like, oh, maybe I need to weigh things differently. Maybe this really was a big deal and
right.
I've minimized it in my head just to survive.
That's exactly how I feel. Like, oh shit, that's not okay. I guess not. You're right. Well, I think about it. Of course it's not okay, but I just never really, it's just such a part
yep.
of my life that it's just like mm-hmm. a thing. Like you don't really think about it. And then someone comes forward and says they're traumatized by it. And like I said, my first reaction was like eye roll. And then my second was like, mm-hmm. wait. No,
nope.
You're right.
Can't normalize this.
If you think about it, that's awful. And I was talking to Travis and somebody was saying one of their stories about their boss making them hold their hand at work.
Oh,
and I was like, oh yeah, okay. I mean, so much worse, but okay. It's gross. And then I was saying to him, I was like, well, I mean, imagine if your boss made you hold her hand at work. And he was like, what? No, I would go to HR immediately. That's horrifying. Why would she do that? And I'm like, oh wait, right. Okay. Yep. That's bad.
Right. Uh-huh.
That's bad. Okay. That's bad.
That's
because
weird.
If it happened to a man, he would be horrified by it. And I just go, holding hands, it could be worse. You know what I mean? So I'm having to like reframe my entire life to be
yes.
like, oh, that's not acceptable. Right. Then it's exhausting because if every
yep.
time something like that happens, I have to feel traumatized about it, then what is my life?
Yes.
Do you know?
Yes.
Yeah.
And you know, I was having this conversation with my boyfriend about who I might have been had it not been for all of these experiences. And has it absolutely formed my core identity, you know, I've been part of forming my core identity of how I see myself, how I see the world, how I react to things. And that part angers me, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
was there another possible me that could have existed outside of all of these things that I have experienced? And I don't know the answer to that. My assumption is yes, but you know, and everybody has those stories, right? Our experiences make us who we are, but it was just one of those thoughts that I had where I'm like, wow, I was formed so early on to react to things in a certain way that it's become just me. That's who I am.
I had the exact same conversation with my boyfriend where I was talking about how angry I am that I am not better at relationships or that I am not healthier. And I've done so much therapy, but I just am so frustrated that I still have these same patterns yep. of behavior, this resistance to trust, this, you know, these same fears. And then it has prevented me from having normal relationships. And it angers me a lot as well.
Wow. I had not thought about it that way. And you made me a little weepy over here, but you're exactly right. Right.
Yeah.
What world would
it
be? What would I be like if I wasn't, raised
yeah.
a girl, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And have to navigate the world in such a way that this is,
yeah.
you know, that this is who we are, and was, you know, what would the possibilities have been? And that just takes me to my own daughter and, you know, wanting so much to insulate her and protect her from being a woman in the world.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, but you know, I can't. There's just experiences that, you know, I can build her with resiliency, and we can, you know, put in trusted people and all of these things that are critical to a healthy life. But, you know, she's going to have her own struggles and her own identity formulation around even the experiences she's already had. And she's only 12.
Yeah.
And so I think it's, that part really, really struck me about, you know, what might have been different in my life had it not been for what I experienced so young.
Right. Same. That's profound. Makes me really sad. Really sad.
Yeah.
We've talked a lot about foster care and how, you know, it would be one of the best things that we could do is try and find, you know, girls who've been in bad situations, because we understand, you know, how that can be. And I know that boyfriend has said that one of the things that he fears the most if we did that is, you know, he's a very large man, you know, he's very tall and he's strong and but he's just a giant teddy bear. You know, he definitely does not have toxic masculinity. Like I am the one in the relationship who is like, you know, the I'm not crying, damn it. And, you know, but he's so scared of if we did something like that and had a girl that was scared of men, you know, how hard that would be for him, how sad it would make him.
Yeah.
But how profound it would be for her to
how we could help somebody.
Experience. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just have a different experience of what it means to be safe and, you know, that it is possible, you know, and those, you know, in as much as the bad experiences that I have had have informed me, so have the ones that have counteracted that belief. And, you know, being able to see the good in people and being able to trust them and being able to grow in that and, mm-hmm. and to understand that I am not just composed. I'm not the sum of everything bad that's happened to me, that I can have experiences that are different than that. And I think that a lot of kids could benefit from having those experiences that don't confirm mm-hmm. what they've already been through.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Agreed. Having good men in your life is profound.
Oh, it is. Mm-hmm. It really is.
It is. It's profound.
It is.
It's true. My grandpa's sitting across the table from me right now eating a plate of mashed potatoes. And I'm very grateful for him.
Me too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there are, you know, and I don't want to paint, just like I don't want to paint women with a broad brush, I don't want to paint men with a broad brush either. You know, I'm in an amazing relationship now that is just, you know, it's flourishing and I'm so proud of it and I'm happy. And I want that to be an example to my daughter about, you know, we can do this right. And you can make good choices and about who you keep in your life and who you don't. And you have the power to do that.
Right.
You have the control to do that.
Yes. And you have the self-worth. You deserve to be treated well, and you are showing her by making those choices for men that are good to you rather than those that are not, that she has that choice and she doesn't have to put up with and she doesn't have to settle for and be treated like shit. And that is an invaluable lesson that we have to teach young girls.
I agree.
Mm-hmm.
I agree.
Yeah.
Oh.
Okay.
That was hard.
Yeah. I needed that though.
Yeah.
I
guess I did too.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, can we talk about Joe Biden and Anita Hill?
Yes.
Because I feel like that sort of segues into this, and it's a kind of inappropriateness that was, it's different than somebody, you know, doing something that actively you know, that was violent against somebody, but it's still something that was hurtful. And I know that Anita Hill in the last several days has been all over the news talking about, you know, Joe Biden owes an explanation or owes an apology or owes more than, you know, what he's given me. And I know that Biden copped to it and said, you know, what I did was wrong and inappropriate. And I know, and he has spent, you know, the last, what, 20 years of his life basically dedicated to violence against women, dedicated to, you know, he's taken up the charge of Obama's It's On Us campaign, has been touring the country talking about it. He's spoken out so many different times. He's talked about consent, and he's really sort of turned his life into this kind of person who advocates against this, but he has this history with her that is not okay. But at the same time, it's like, at what point does he make up for it? At what point, you know, can you say,
this is exactly what we were trying to talk about. Like, I have to believe that people can change. And I think that the Anita Hill hearings, it was horrific what happened and what he did was wrong. However, I believe that that impacted him seriously, changed his life. I believe that he was made aware of that behavior and of the way that he treated her and the sort of way that the whole thing unfolded. And I think that's the reason in some ways that he has spent every year since then dedicated to women's issues, is because it was brought to his attention. And I think he decided to change the way that he treats women. I do.
Can I chime in a couple things here? Please. You know, I've been also paying attention to the Biden Anita Hill stuff, and there were a couple really good stories. One was in the Washington Post. Isn't it sort of weird in a very perverse way that was a snapshot of when when bipartisanship was in effect to be this horrible old boys club that was patriarchal and misogynistic, with, you know, Biden not wanting to upset his Republican counterparts because, hey, it's the president's nominee. We have to confirm him. Like, it's just crazy to think that the irony of bipartisanship, the way it worked against Anita Hill back then.
Yeah.
But but another thing I wanted to bring up, and it's Biden is not exactly in this category, but here's the problem. And this is what really irks me. And I'm sure you guys notice it too. When it comes to Al Franken or John Conyers or any of these other Democratic names that are popping up with this bad behavior, the problem is, and you mentioned it, Sarah, watching Fox News last night, this is a cudgel that the right can use to say, I'll see both sides. And when that happens, that din becomes louder and the mainstream media picks up on it and popular culture kind of picks up on it. And then there is this thought that, well, it really is both sides. And then people tune out, and then the one party that really truly does believe in preventing violence against women and patriarchy and reproductive rights and victims' rights is sort of drowned out. And because then they can take the high road of saying, well, people on both sides of the aisle, they do it too.
And they're hypocrites. Yes. Democrats are hypocrites because they fight for women's rights.
Right. And it's not fair. But that's why I honestly think, like, we got to take a hard line on perhaps Al Franken and certainly on John Conyers and some of these other people. Otherwise, we do lose the moral high ground and then we lose the fight entirely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, it's, you know, again, it's that struggle of personal experience becoming political. But that's really the crossroads that we are in. Is, I agree. I think that there is a false equivalency and that there is a purposeful effort to saturate with so much that it just becomes meaningless. And, you know, it's frustrating to watch and it's frustrating to be a part of, but it's completely predictable. I don't think anybody who has watched the news cycle over the past decade would have been surprised by, you know, this turn of events becoming a both sides, you know, do it. So therefore it's meaningless.
It's infuriating. When you see Chuck Grassley say, oh yeah, we better investigate Al Franken, the media does not, the mainstream media does not follow up with the fact that Chuck Grassley fought to not reauthorize the Violence Against Women Act, that Chuck Grassley was one of the authors of these arcane congressional rules where people like the Conyers accusers have very little recourse and have to do these meaningless settlements. Like, we don't get the big picture because it's very easy clickbait to say, ah, see both sides.
Yep. And it does matter. It does matter what people do with their vote. Sort of the point I was trying to make about Al Franken a couple weeks ago was, you know, it matters to me that there's someone in office that did something wrong, but that every time millions of women's lives and rights and things come up for a vote, he fucking votes for us. He votes in my interest and in the interests of all women. And that matters. It matters that our party votes to protect women. And we're going to have some bad eggs because in the end, sexual assault isn't political. It happens literally everywhere, all the time, in every industry, across the board, period. Yep. But it matters that some of these men have done the right thing by women and some of them have not.
Exactly.
Yep. I totally agree with that. And I hope that, you know, again, going back to Trump, you know, the fact that, that each story that comes out is not followed up by, oh, by the way, America, you voted for a rapist, is just, I mean, until that starts to happen, it's kind of, it's just shooting fish in a barrel. I mean, of course all these men have done things that they're probably not proud of. I don't know that I know a single man who hasn't done at least one thing that he's not terribly proud of, but it matters what they do with that. And I wish that that were the story that we were talking about, not just the behavior.
Yeah. What do you do after? What did you learn from it? What conversations did you have? I don't want to hear, I was drunk and closeted, so oops. Mm-hmm. I don't want to hear, oh, well, I went to therapy, so I'm probably fine now. Like, I want to know what you learned. I want to know how, what you're going to do differently. How are you going to make your life impactful and help women? You know, somebody said about Louis C.K. the other day, what he needs to do is shut up and start supporting women that are comics.
Yeah. Just,
that's it. You have so much star power. You have so much power and so many fans and so much popularity. Don't just shut up and go away.
Use your
shut
platform
up and
to do
start
something.
Helping female comedians, period. Help women in your field. And don't take any, I don't give a shit. I don't want to hear from you, but I want you to help the women in your industry that you can help. And he could.
I agree.
Yeah.
I had totally forgotten about Louis C.K. So many stories.
I know.
Well, too, I mean, I hear all these people talking about Conyers and the settlement that he got. The only reason that people are blowing up about Conyers is because that's the only survivor that has come forward of all of those lawsuits and all of those settlements. I mean, if you start digging into who else on that list.
And they will.
And you're going to find a lot of Republicans. I'm remembering Mark Foley, you know, trying to go after the pages.
Right.
I mean.
So they quit the page program.
Yeah, they had to cut the whole page program because of Mark Foley.
Right. We don't tell men stop fucking the pages. We just say, I guess we can't have a page program. Because men literally don't know how to control themselves.
It's the Mike Pence philosophy, right? Well, I'm just not going to be alone with a woman. It's like, oh, because you can't control
because you
what
can't
you
control
do
yourself.
Your penis.
It's insane.
It literally has a mind of its own.
It's the same kind of philosophy that we start teaching girls in elementary school, though.
Yep.
Like, you can't wear certain clothing because men will look at you and be distracted and they can't pay attention. So you're at fault for what you're wearing because of their inability to control themselves. This starts at the very beginning of life where women are blamed for men's poor behavior.
Yeah. And women are taught how not to get raped, but we don't do a lot of explaining to boys not to fucking rape.
Yeah.
I've been waiting for my rape my whole life. My parents raised me to believe it's around every corner. It's in every alley. It's in every grocery store. It's in the backseat of my car. It's literally everywhere that you go. Your rape is waiting for you. So you better learn ways to combat that. And I don't think they spent any time telling my brothers about anything. Consent or, you know, being responsible for yourself. Or I mean, my brothers are both incredible men who respect women, but they're not waiting for their rape, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. You said that. It's so crazy you say that. I'm remembering now my great aunt when I was probably 10 years old teaching me that you always look in your back seat before you get in your car. And I, at the time, I didn't even know or understand why. Mm-hmm. And now thinking back to that, I'm like, oh my God, this started so early.
So early.
Yep. My ex-wife said in her women's studies class, you had to actually check under your car because sometimes men hide under the car and like try to slash your Achilles with a razor blade or something.
Yeah. I mean, my whole life, I was even trying to process it with my therapist because I have this very ingrained notion of men are scary. And I was trying to process with her, like, how that leads to anxiety and all kinds of other things. But I said, fundamentally, it's true. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a way to live in the world. My dad gives me mace every year for Christmas, literally. He gives me and all the women in my family mace for Christmas. And there's some way to reckon between those two things, but it's not entirely untrue. Men are scary, and the world is scary, and shit happens to women all the time.
Well, on that note, we're gonna take a break. I hope you guys can stick around for a minute, but if not, thanks for coming on. And hopefully, after the break, we will have at least one more guest, but we'll see. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Irreverent Testimony. Molly had to run, take care of some family business, but Sarah is still here with us.
Hello!
And I don't know what you guys necessarily wanted to talk about. We planned this all out really well, as usual. But I have a couple ideas, unless you guys have anything in particular.
I have one thing real quick. I don't know how quick, but the case of Cyntoia Brown, have you been following this, Sarah?
I haven't, no.
Okay. So this young woman, Cyntoia Brown is her name, was tried and convicted of murder and given a life sentence. The crime for which she was convicted was killing a man who had bought her for sex when she was 16 years old. She was sex trafficked by a guy who went by Cutthroat, who was a drug dealer from the time she was about 14. And she grew up in a really rough, you know, home. Her mom was an addict and drank throughout her pregnancy and was raped multiple times when she was a kid. And anyway, so she was basically drugged and raped by various different men over the course of a couple of years and then sold to this realtor guy. And he took her to his house and she thought he was reaching for a gun and she took a gun out of her purse and shot him in the head. And she was convicted of first degree murder and given a life sentence. She will not be eligible for parole until she is 69 years old. She is currently 29. This case isn't new, but, apparently there was a documentary made about it. And then I guess a bunch of celebrities, kind of caught onto it and took up the mantle, including Kim Kardashian, which I was kind of delighted by, decided to have her lawyers pay for her lawyers to go see if she can help this woman on appeal. So I just was reading about it. I had kind of heard about it in the news the past couple of days, but today I decided to just actually read about it. And it's just horrifying. It's just absolutely devastating.
Makes me feel like our whole justice system is so jacked up right now.
Yeah. And, you know, you wonder why, like, we're talking about that, you know, what do you do in a situation like she's in and why women don't come forward and all the things. And it's like, you know, this young woman finally had the courage to do something and now she's going to serve life in prison for it. And I don't know.
There are... laws in some states that have been passed in probably just the last maybe 5-10 years that punish women who are the parents, the mothers of children who are abused. So if a woman is dating a guy who ends up abusing their child, they too are held accountable. And what has happened in a lot of these cases is that, like in Oklahoma, Oklahoma is one of the states that passed this law. In Oklahoma, there was a woman who typically had a babysitter, had a regular babysitter that watched her kid whenever she went to work. The babysitter was sick, couldn't come, so she didn't know what to do. She had been dating this guy for a while and decided, all right, you know, I'll let him watch my kid while I'm at work. And something happened with the guy and the kid died. Like the guy killed the kid.
Oh my God.
She was put in prison for longer than he was for killing the child. She got a longer sentence than he did. And she's not the only one that's happened to. It's happened a bunch in Oklahoma. And Oklahoma is one of the states that has the highest number of women in prisons right now. And there are a ton of states that operate this way. And
why does that not surprise me? Like, it just, you're telling me this story and I'm like, oh, she's going to get it worse than he is. And you're right. I mean, it's like... it's so impossible to hold men accountable for anything.
Yeah, and you add to the fact that there are often, you know, people have public defenders, and John Oliver's talked about the problem with the public defender system and the overwhelmed lawyers who are just trying to get through as many as possible and, you know, have good intentions and go into this with you know, a good heart, hoping to help people, and then just discover that they're the only ones, you know? Yeah. And
yep. There's an excellent documentary about that called Gideon's Army that I highly recommend, about public defenders and the public defense system. And it's called Gideon's Army because Gideon v. Wainwright was the Supreme Court decision that allowed for public defenders, that said that you have a constitutional right to a lawyer, and just how badly we fucked that up since that happened and how overstretched these people are. And and then we have the whole problem with plea bargaining and how 90% of cases don't even get to trial. And yeah, so then pile it on. Yeah. Wow. That's horrifying. Okay. What do you got, Trev?
I was wondering, Sarah, if you had seen the piece, I think it came out yesterday, the puff piece in the New York Times about Ben Shapiro.
I didn't.
Mm-mm, me either.
I try not to read news until the second I had to go to work. And
I've just had enough of the New York Times. I just have. Like, there's still some good writers there. They still break some good news. But they are in love with these puff pieces on these horrible garbage people. And Ben Shapiro may be one of the worst. If you don't know who he is, he was a Breitbart writer who decided they were too anti-Semitic for him. And he left. But he's still an awful, horrible, garbage, homophobe, transphobe, terrible, awful, horrible, garbage person. But if you haven't read it yet, we can save that for another time. But
it's a love letter to him or something.
He's a provocateur and he's daring and it's just, you know, all the stupid buzzwords, because there's a segment of the media, of the mainstream media, that like is like, hey, you know, the alt right appealing to the millennials is a thing. We got to get on. You know, we got to talk about that. And it's friggin' gross and disgusting and horrible, and I'm really sick of it. And something like 70% of millennials want nothing to do with the right and Republicans, but they're not interviewing us because that's not fun. It's much more fun to talk about the Pepe the Frog avatars and
they are the minority. It's because millennials are so progressive and are so far left that the very few that are far right are outside the norm.
Right.
You know, it's like we as a generation are, we tend to go to the left. So that's a story that everybody told, you know, in 2008 when we all helped Barack Obama get elected.
Right.
And the very few Milos of the world are so rare that it's like, you know, it's the unicorn they want to cover.
Yeah, but, I'm just sick of it.
And this is, you're right, this isn't the only puff piece that they've done. They've done a couple of right-wing puff pieces over the last couple of weeks, because I can't remember who it was that I saw, and well, I was just like, what
I
is this?
They're contractually obligated to do 7 or 8 on Ivanka, so I'm sure there were a few of those.
Mm-hmm.
And did you, what a lovely Thanksgiving centerpiece she came up with, by the way.
Oh my God, that was the most fun thing. People making fun of that just made my day. Look, Jake Tapper too was going after her.
Look, I'm no Martha Stewart, okay? So I wouldn't know a nice decorative centerpiece from a pile of garbage, but it looked like a pile of garbage.
No, it literally,
and a clam.
No, she's literally a wood witch who went and gathered some trash and stuck it in a clamshell of all things for reasons that I still don't understand.
Well, I'm sure she didn't have anything to do with that. Like some intern threw something together at a deadline.
Look, I'm an ex-florist. Let me just tell you. I do know the difference. I'm basically Martha Stewart over here, and that's garbage. I wonder what Martha Stewart thought, by the way.
I'm sure she rolled her eyes and then smoked a joint with Snoop.
Well, that's a lovely image, yes.
I know. I actually did a funny puff piece on Martha Stewart on how much better she is since she got out of prison.
Totally, right?
Right? Like, there was this night...
relatable and, like, yeah.
Just super chill. Mm-hmm. I found a 1986 video of Martha talking about how not to get too stressed out at the holidays. Just think about the ways that you can make this year better than every other year. And it's like, oh, thanks, Martha. No pressure there. And she's just like so, so young and so totally yuppie looking. And now she's, mm-hmm. yeah, and now she's just this super, I mean, she's always been very, very smart, obviously. Mm-hmm. She started out as a stockbroker, and but now she's just super chill, and I love watching her and Snoop do stuff together. It just cracks me up.
I don't watch it, but I think
she's the
idea
Kathy
of it
Griffin,
is
then?
Hilarious. She's the new Kathy Griffin.
Yeah.
I wouldn't go that far.
Was the Snoop side piece for a while.
Oh my God.
Oh, I don't know.
He likes the older white ladies.
Her recipes are pretty legit.
No, for sure.
They're hit or miss. They're hit or miss.
Mm.
The brining that she did that she recommends for turkeys is really good. My friend James did that a couple years ago, and oh man.
Good to know.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to turn into a conversation about food.
Sure you did. 'Tis the season.
Right?
Anyway, moving on. Word on the street is that Michael Flynn may be officially flipping. Which
yeah,
we
really?
Kind of already knew might be a thing, but...
I didn't hear this. What happened?
Well, his lawyers have stopped talking to Trump's lawyers. And what that basically means is probably that they're either talking or they're trying to work out a deal or they're doing something. And I guess that was kind of inevitable. And you got to love the Ty Cobb, this lawyer.
From Denver, yes, with his mustache.
He's the new Iraqi defense minister, you know, the guy that's standing there where the bombs are going off in the background.
Yeah.
No, nothing's happening.
Nothing's happening. Baghdad's fine.
Everything's fine.
Everything's good.
Baghdaddy Bob or whatever they call them.
Yeah. So I don't know. Any thoughts on that, Sarah, where we're heading with that? I mean, it's like every time there's a new piece of news, the media is like, oh yeah, that Russia thing. Oh, that's like a big deal still, right?
I feel like, oh my God, every single mention of Russia, I feel like we write about. We really focus on it a lot. And with the Michael Flynn thing, it was so interesting because I remember very, very early on in this thing, he was telling Congress that he was telling the FBI that if they would give him immunity, that he would tell them everything.
That was mm-hmm. a rumor, yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, that was legit. That was
no, that was like legit. Like he was saying that out,
and
out
they
in
were,
public.
They were like, no.
And they were like, "No, we're good.
Nope, we got
it.
Thanks."
So he got he got something, but probably not full immunity. Maybe there's some people that speculate it's about his friggin' ne'er-do-well conspiracy theorist son that he's trying to save his ass. So.
Yeah, that's what people were talking about last night. And the other thing that I wonder is, I know that they got the plea from Papadopoulos, and I know that they got a ton of documents from Donald Trump Jr. And so I'm wondering if all of those documents and all of that information that they've got, and from Manafort too, I'm wondering if all of that stuff has basically just completely screwed the Flynns over, both Jr. and Senior. And so they know that they're going down, but they can't, but like Mueller and the FBI can't quite get to Trump yet.
Well, the thing is, his kids are so stupid.
True.
They are.
It's like, you know, the whole cabal is so arrogant, and they're so dumb, these two. It's like, they are gonna fuck it up. They're gonna pull the Colonel Jessup and probably say what Mueller wants to hear at some point. Because why shouldn't we be allowed to collude with Russia? We're Trumps.
They're the mm-hmm. exemplification of rich white privilege. I mean, they just don't know anything, and they don't think that they should be able to do. They literally think whatever we mm-hmm. want to do, we can do. Why wouldn't we? We've always done everything we wanted. Why would there be accountability now? Yeah, it's pretty insane.
That's a perfect description for Donald Trump Jr., because you just keep seeing him, you know, throw this stuff out there like, well, yeah, I did this, or yeah, I said that. And you're just like, dude, what lawyer is
working
for you?
And like, stop talking.
They're trying to analyze it like, oh, well, what's the strategy? I'm like, I don't think there's a strategy.
No.
I just don't think he gives a crap. And to this point, he's getting away with it, so...
Yeah. And he's been brought up to think he's above the law, and he's watched his father break the law over and over and over again.
Right.
So he just thinks, well, this is clearly not a big deal.
No,
you know,
right.
Don't you know who I am?
Right. Exactly that. Exactly.
And but it's like Carter Page, but more entitled.
Yeah.
Oh, man. If this whole thing, I'm horribly frightened, not just because it means the Trumps would somehow skate and still be in power, but if this cadre of entitled idiots doesn't all go, you know, to prison, I kind of give up on everything. Like, how could they not? And Flynn is next, right? Kushner's going to be indicted. That's kind of inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, where it ends up as far as Trump, who knows?
If we've got Trump Jr., and we've got Kushner, then if you've read the biographies or you've heard the biographers talk about Donald Trump and the way that he's handled his business over the last, you know, several decades, nothing happens without him approving it. Even his children, like every single thing, every decision has to be run by him, even if his children are the ones handling the project. So there is no way that this doesn't go to him. And so that's why I keep thinking that maybe Mueller has the information, has enough information to prove that there were conversations that Trump did know about it because of Papadopoulos.
Of course there were. Of course. And the thing is proving it.
Yeah, so now they've got to have the documents to be able to prove it. And so maybe that is why they made the deal with the Flynns. I think the biggest problem that we're going to run into is that Donald Trump doesn't email. So there, and he has done, I don't remember if there was
a
lawsuit.
He doesn't email.
I think that there was a lawsuit maybe 15 years ago or something ridiculous like that, where an email that he had created a paper trail that screwed him over, and he had to settle a lawsuit. And so
now he just tweets, because that's not admissible as evidence, I guess.
But I think a lawyer told him at the time, never put anything in writing, never email anything. And I think at that point he stopped using email. And I know that he had an assistant who would receive all of his emails and then print them out for him in hard copy form. And then he would either call people or he would, you know, whatever. But I think that is where the paper trail concern happens with Trump, is you have to be able to prove, there has to be some documents or some information that prove the connection to Russia. And maybe it's his taxes. Maybe it's emails to his assistant. Maybe it's that photo with Papadopoulos and Mike Pence and Trump sitting around a table.
Is other people's testimony enough evidence? I mean, if they get Papadopoulos and Flynn and Manafort to say, here's what happened, do we need documents that prove that they're right?
I don't think you would. I mean, if you've got them being willing to cop a plea, Then maybe. But remember whenever Trump pardoned Joe Arpaio, it was people were talking about, I wonder if that's a signal to the to Manafort and to Flynn that they shouldn't flip because he will pardon the people who are loyal to him.
Hmm. Well, maybe. But pardoning Arpaio is, I mean, Arpaio's a horrible garbage person, but it's sort of small potatoes in terms of what they're looking to get Manafort on.
Totally. But it's like one of those things where it's a Trump rewards people who are loyal to him. Mm-hmm. And
right. And it was controversial. And it wasn't that they had anything to do with Russia, just that, hey, I'm totally willing to use
you're my friend
power, whether it's controversial or not. I don't give a shit because you're my friend.
Yeah.
As a signal to the people who might flip on him. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Is he that smart or is he just playing? Because I sort of took the Arpaio thing as just playing to his base. Just saying, no, I'm actually racist. Don't forget.
Well, that's part of it. That's sort of a bonus.
Yeah, I think it's a loyalty thing. Like, that's the one thing that people talk about is that whoever is loyal to Trump, he will be loyal to, you know, to them in so much as he'll hire them or, you know, let them head projects or whatever. He'll right. flip on them, you know, if they on a dime, if it means saving his own ass. But but for the most part, loyalty is one of the most important things to him. And that's why he surrounds himself with his children, because he feels like they're the most loyal.
Wow. Yeah. Well, then moving on from there to the nightmare tax bill.
Oh my God.
Which nobody seems to know for sure if they're actually going to pass this. I think there's a chance they will. I think they've sort of become fatalistic and suicidal, and they know that there's calamity coming, and they know that if they lose their donors, they really lose everything.
Mm-hmm. Like the voters, if they just lose a win.
Yeah. Well, I mean, no, they need a win, sure. But they except for a few idiots maybe, aren't under this impression that this is polling well. So I think they know the potential for long-term damage, but if they lose that Adelson and Koch money, then mm-hmm. they're really screwed right away. So I think they might saddle us with that. And the scare.
Well,
oh, go ahead, Sarah.
So there are a couple of different people that I think about whenever I think about this tax bill. I mean, even if Roy Moore wins and he gets seated by the time that they would need to pass the tax reform bill, if they keep that one component in it about the Obamacare deal, I can't see Susan Collins in Maine voting for it to begin with.
Well, Murkowski says she might be okay with that mm-hmm. now. I don't know if that's you know.
But then you've also got Bob Corker, who just said that he's not going to run for re-election. Corker yeah. signed that Corker signed that tax pledge or that pledge that the Grover Norquist pledge that said that he would never vote for something that added to the national debt.
Yeah, but they only really care about that when there's a Democrat as president. Let's face it.
I don't know. I mean, if he's not running for re-election, then it could not. I think he could go either way. And then you've got Jeff Flake, who's also not running for re-election, and he's pissed at Trump right now.
Yeah. I don't know, but these people really are these crazy tax fetishists. And they've been waiting for a chance to vote on a bill like this forever.
And Ron Johnson of Wisconsin already came out against it.
Well, yeah, I mean, but then he changed his tune, I thought, just the other day a little bit.
I don't know. The thing that I heard him say was that if they can pass it without me, then let them, because I'm not going to vote for the tax package.
Yeah, that was just a few days ago he may have changed his tune some, but I don't know. I could see them doing it, and I think it would be it would obviously be disastrous for the economy. And it would be politically disastrous for them, but it's like, LOL, nothing matters, whatever. We need a win, it looks like.
I'm just going to ask a question here, and you and I kind of touched on this the other day, and Dana and I were talking about it a little bit too. At what point do liberals stop saving conservatives from themselves? I'm kind of done with this. Look, you voted this way. This is what you voted for. So maybe I just let you die with no health insurance and raise your taxes and have some sort of paramilitary force and just, I don't know, like at what point do we hold them accountable for their own fucking vote?
Promise
because so far, they did all of this. Everything that's been attempted was promised. They did it, and then they look to us to come save them, and we keep doing it. And I'm wondering why.
I've been saying that for a while because Kansas did the same thing, and look what happened there. And Oklahoma, when I worked on the governor's race in 2010, they did the exact same thing, where you know a lot of people were saying, "Okay, we gotta win these seats back, and all this other stuff." And I was like, you know, I'm kind of thinking maybe we just let it burn.
Yeah.
Yeah, but but is it,
fuck them
now? Yeah, and some races are being won, but has Kansas or Oklahoma become a bastion of Democratic leadership now?
Well, Oklahoma definitely has won. I mean, they've won like what six out of eight special election seats over the last 2 years.
It's starting to turn a little bit, yeah.
And I know that my Republican family certainly hates Mary Fallon. And they're starting to get angry about the idea of not having services. And I'm just hoping that people are smart enough to put that together that, no, this is what happens when you cut DHS funding. Children end up being killed because there are no workers to go in and check on foster kids or whatever.
Right.
But I don't know if people are putting things together, if they're figuring it out. I know Kansas
saving them from their political reality. If we don't make them aware and understand that when you vote Republican, these are the things that will happen to you. If we keep swooping in and saving everything and making sure that they don't enact the very things that people put them in office to enact, then do they ever not vote Republican? I mean, what stakes are there? They can just vote their fucking hearts away, and then we'll come in, swoop in, make sure they don't do anything disastrous. I feel like the mom and dad in the room, and we're just letting them be fucking infant child and with no accountability.
Yeah, don't stick your fork in the electric socket. Don't do it. Mm-hmm. It's like, what?
But I think there are a lot of people that are going to get caught in the crossfire.
I know.
That's the thing that stops me
and
from
us
being
too.
Like,
it affects us too. Our taxes will be screwed. Our health care could be screwed. The people we love, the people we care about. If it was just isolated to the people who voted for this, then yeah, but it's not, obviously.
I know. That's why
That's why Democrats will always probably swoop in, is they'll be like, well, hell,
can't actually let people die, and we can't actually let this happen, and okay, fine. But Jesus, it's exhausting, and it just feels grossly unfair.
The thing that I wish Democrats did better is whenever they do swoop in to fix this, we don't take a victory lap. We're very humble about it. We just are like, okay, we fixed this, what's next? And that was one of the things that Obama was terrible with, because he's a humble guy.
Yep.
He didn't go out there and do a million rallies and be like, this is what I did. Yep. You know, Democrats did this. We won. And the reason that you're being able to have this or have that is because we won. We got this for you.
That's right.
And Trump,
that messaging thing that we keep talking about, we keep hammering it on this podcast, because it's like, you have to tell people what you stand for and what you've accomplished, or they don't know. They have no idea what Democrats want or do. They don't know because we don't tell them.
And Trump takes credit for stuff that he had no involvement in to begin with.
Yes.
So,
well, sure, yeah. I mean, he takes credit for everything.
Everything that's good. Nothing that's bad. No, you're right, though. You're right. We do need to take way more credit for the things that we do.
And that comes from the top. That's bad management at the DNC. It's bad management for the governor's associations and the Senate. And there needs to be somebody who is coordinating everything, saying, all right, everybody go out there, go do a town hall. This is the sentence everybody's going to repeat over and over again for the next 2 weeks.
Yep. Yeah, we're terrible at that.
Yep.
And it's mind boggling.
And they're good at it. We're good at governing. We're terrible about telling anyone what we did. Or why we're good.
Why we want to do it.
Or why we're good.
Messaging, period.
Yeah, we just don't do that. We just presume that, of course, they'll know. It's fine. They saw. No, they didn't see. They don't know. They're busy. They've got kids. They're at work. Tell them.
And they're in a right-wing echo chamber in their small town where, you know, all they hear is the pseudo-reality.
That's one of the things that a reporter from Alabama was saying, is that a lot of the problem in Alabama with the approvals for Roy Moore, despite the allegations, is that they are really in a far right echo chamber, and that the stories are really just not getting through. So the only way that people are being able to get this information is through the internet. And, you know, even then, people are only looking at things that that confirm their own beliefs.
Right. You're speaking not going to go seeking out something you don't want to hear.
Speaking of which, very quietly, because of everything else that was going on, the FCC has laid the groundwork to destroy net neutrality.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Comcast came out, no, don't worry, we're not going to, we're not going to. Well, you could trust us. We're Comcast.
And sure, of course, like, Comcast.
LOL, right. And I don't know where this goes, because with all the attention focused elsewhere, I don't know that we're going to have – because when this came up last time, there was so much pushback and public pushback and protesting mm-hmm. and everything else mm-hmm. that they had to kind of back off. And Congress had to kind of say, oh, no, we should probably keep net neutrality. But now, under this cloud of everything else, I think they can try to sort of sneak this through.
And they're not even going through Congress. The FCC is just going to do a rule change, which means mm-hmm. it doesn't matter if you call your senators or your representatives.
No, they could pass legislation.
They could.
But they're not, probably, with this Congress.
No.
I think if they do a rule change, there'll be court battles and lawsuits, yeah. and that's where it'll go first. The only saving grace that I can think of is that tried and true Republican value of the free market.
Right.
If Comcast and, whoever the hell else, Verizon or Cox or whatever, decide that they want to restrict people's internet, I think that presents a possibility of somebody like Google, who believes in net neutrality, coming in and really investing in a huge infrastructure for high-speed internet all across the country. And maybe that, they could partner with Microsoft. They could all of these tech companies could partner together against the telcos and be like, okay, you want to try this? Guess what? We're going to give high-speed internet to everybody who wants to buy it. And it's going to give people whatever, websites they want, from Netflix to Amazon to everything. And you talk about the richest people in the country, like Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates and, all of these Google guys, they could fund this. They could really fund an entirely different infrastructure against the telcos and completely destroy their companies.
And it depends how big their egos are, whether they would want to get behind something like that. But that's
I don't think it's possible. An ego thing, though. I think it's a moneymaker. If people have an option for a crappy internet service that won't let them watch Netflix and an internet service that lets them watch whatever they want and see whatever they want, who are they going to buy?
Well, unless they all collude and say, well, we're all going to do this, which isn't what often happens. But yeah, no, that's a good point.
Free market at its best.
But see, you bring up the free market thing, and they've been able to twist it. Like, my libertarian friend, back when this was coming up before, said, oh, no, the government shouldn't step in and say how – like, he was arguing it against net neutrality. And I'm like, oh, dude, you're really buying that
pumpkin. No. To Dana's point, too, he said, if we fuck this up, right, if we take net neutrality away, you can't ever get it back. It's done. Once it's done, it's done. There's no going back. So
I don't know.
Careful here.
I think that there's a way that we could do it. We would just have to. There would have to be some sort of campaign that would publicly try to organize the internet, the Silicon Valley guys.
Yeah, and there needs to be an education campaign. Because this is not, for me at least, I don't think this is a left-right issue. I think this is a money issue. And I think if you could explain it properly, again, back to messaging, mm-hmm. Like my folks wouldn't be for it if they understood exactly what it means. Nobody would. Like, no consumer of the internet would be for this if they understood exactly what was going to happen.
Yeah, but all they'll hear is on Fox News that somehow freedom, something, don't let the government...
The market... Something.
Dictate something. Mm-hmm. So,
I wonder to the extent to which you could argue that the internet has become a utility.
Well,
because
that's what a lot of the pending litigation,
the lawsuits,
around.
Because you can say that information is a right that people should have, just as water, and electricity and stuff like that.
Yeah, we don't do so great on water either.
That's true.
I mean, maybe we can win a court battle, but that doesn't mean that it'll be...
Not poisoned.
Not poisoned, yeah. Not properly enforced.
Man.
I know. And it's been a year, you know, since the world turned upside down. And gosh.
I feel like I've aged a million years.
Me too. I feel
I'm
old
so tired.
And tired, yeah. Tired of fighting. I'm tired. I'm just tired.
Yeah, we thought 2016 sucked, but...
No. It was just a primer, you know.
So what else? Mm-hmm. We got about 10 minutes left. How do we want to wrap this up? Any other interesting stories that we want to discuss?
I love that Barack Obama came out and kind of did a little bit of a smackdown to Trump after his, you know, we're winning Thanksgiving message to the troops thing. I want to see more of that.
So I didn't get any of that. I didn't catch that. So what happened?
I think it was a tweet. He just like, he just made just a snarky comment. Trump did this video where he, which is typical, like presidents will send videos to the troops. What's hilarious is that Mike Pence actually went to a base and served dinner to the troops. It was like, oh, somebody's kind of...
Mm-hmm. Trying to
upstaging, upstaging there.
There was golf to be played. Come on.
Uh-huh. But I mean, Obama gave a very typical, you know, from our family to yours. We give thanks for things. You know, blah blah blah. And Trump was just like, hey, happy Thanksgiving, peace out. I'm going to golf. And it's funny because the more that you can. The more that I just wish he would get out there more. Like when he did the speech for Ralph Northam in Virginia, you know, I felt that sense of hope and possibility again.
Yeah.
And I miss that. That is the one thing that we don't have anymore. No. And
I think part of that is he's hoping to back off and let some future party leaders take that mantle, but they just don't do it as well as he does.
And I think everybody is too paranoid to do it right now because the second that they do it, then they will become Trump's target. And then there will be a 3-year long campaign against them.
Yeah, and that's true.
That may not be a bad thing at this point to position yourself as the anti-Trump.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. I know that
there's some danger there, too. As we've seen in some of these special elections, just being against Trump doesn't win elections. We've realized.
True.
You have to have a message. And if I were a person sitting in Congress right now, I wouldn't want to go on the defense for the next 3 years.
Yeah.
That's expensive and exhausting. And if you have even a single bone of a skeleton in any closet, it's going to come out sometime in the next 3 years. So I get it. I get it. But it is disheartening. We don't have that voice right now, for sure.
And I think that's why people like, you know, Obama and Biden and Warren and the people we know are not going to run should get out there and make people feel a little less hopeless.
We know that Biden and Warren aren't going to run?
Actually, I don't know if Biden is going to run. I don't think that he will. I think if there is a viable person that he likes that he gets wind of that's going to run, I don't think he would.
He's going to be so old.
I know, that's the thing. And I think he knows that and understands that. Elizabeth Warren, it's the same way. She, not only does she not want to be president, she thinks that she's too old for it and wants to see somebody younger step up. She's too just incredibly insane about her grandkids to walk away. You know, like if you watch her social media and see what she's doing all the time, it's just like constantly she wants to be around her grandkids making cookies and stuff like that. So I think she's a family person and, you know, she's from Oklahoma. So I feel that.
Yeah. God knows I wouldn't want to do that goddamn job.
So I don't think she has ever wanted it. And, you know, I think she was happy at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which just got Mick Mulvaney just got put in charge of.
And that's another thing. We did a piss poor job of explaining to anybody what that was and how that works. And the media, of course, didn't help. They mm-hmm. just talked about the controversy. But yeah, that was a great thing that like 95% of America would be behind if they understood what it was and why it was there and how it came out. And instead, no, it's, oh, it's this thing that
Elizabeth Warren did. That, so it's
awful. Republicans don't like mm-hmm. it. So. Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you saw the thing about Tillerson, that broke in the New York Times last night that completely got buried, that he is trying to force career diplomats out of the State Department.
Well, they've what? Been doing that for since day one. Yeah. They're trying to destroy the whole diplomatic corps
Jesus
of the State Department.
Jesus fuck.
Which, I mean, it's one thing if you have a partisan problem and you want to get rid of the political appointees. I totally get that. That is normal. That happens between administrations. We're talking about people who are just civil service people. They're not, this is not about partisanship for them. They're just really good about, you know, this specific country. They speak the language. They know the politics.
Yeah, I have so a friend who works in that exactly what she is, precisely what she is. And it took her years to be able to have that job. She had to take, like, her language skills had to be, like, insanely way better than just even conversational, like, all these tests, all this crazy shit. And it's not partisan or political or anything. She is a civil servant.
And they're either making them, he's either firing them, pushing them out, or assigning them to work with interns to humiliate them so that they will want to resign.
Wow.
And I mean, I've heard stories all over Washington about all of these, you know, like lawyers who are working for all of the departments, lawyers at the Pentagon, like people who are like, screw this. I can make way more money in the private sector. I did this out of a sense of duty. I don't want to work for this idiot. I'm going to go.
Yeah.
And it's kind of the same sort of situation with people in the State Department where they're like, why would I subject myself to this kind of humiliation when I could be making way more money and have more time off with my family, you know, in the private sector. And yep. So it's just like getting rid of all of these people. Already the State Department is understaffed.
Yes.
Because
every
they've
branch
been,
of government is. Yes.
Because they've been slow to hire people because they didn't think they were going to win. Nobody wants to work for them. And it's certainly costing the government a hell of a lot less, but it's putting us in real danger with the State Department not being staffed like that.
Well, and who wants that? That the Russians, Putin. That's exactly.
Exactly. He wants the greatest amount of chaos that he can get in the United States.
And you would think at a certain point, a Republican who understands this might step in and say, maybe this is not what we want, but those voices are few and far between.
But they want the tax bill to pass.
They want the mm-hmm. tax bill to pass. So.
Mm-hmm. And McCain has come out and said, like, I don't need anybody. I don't need to staff these positions.
I alone can fix it.
I can fix it. It's fine. Don't worry about it. Like, I'm not doing mm-hmm. it on purpose. And you're like, holy shit, that's not how
yeah,
any of this
works.
Who
needs to foster American interests abroad?
Yeah. No.
Screw
it's
it.
Fine.
Whatever.
He'll just go forcibly shake hands with the leader and it'll be fine, I'm sure.
That's the thing that always surprises me about how the Republican Party and how American idealism changed is that we used to talk about democracy building. And it was one of the reasons that I thought very seriously about going into foreign service and doing international policy is because this idea of, you know, I believe in democracy. I believe in the American idea. And I want everybody to have the opportunities that America has all over the world. And, you know, that youthful idealism that I once had. And yes. So
it's gone.
Seeing that now, it's just like, oh my God, you would think that people, you know, that Republicans still had that Americans still had that passion and that understanding of exceptionalism and that we would want to share that. And
well,
instead, they
would, if Obama was doing this, they'd be losing their minds.
Right.
So it's just fully partisan.
And you've got Trump just saying stuff like, well, now we're respected abroad. It's like, no, there's nobody abroad anymore. That's
right.
The thing. Like,
right.
We don't know if we're respected or not because nobody's there.
Right. God. And well, it's only been a year.
I know.
We're about out of time. Go ahead. Finish your thoughts, sir.
I was going to say, it makes me think that perhaps this will be over soon. That, you know, at some point things will get so bad because there aren't any
staffers there. There is a tipping point?
Yeah, because if you don't have any staffers to protect you or insulate you or fix things or whatever, then it means that all of it's going to come crashing down on somebody.
Yeah. I hope you're right. I don't know if I can do three more of these years.
Right.
I think I'm going to survive. Lord. I'll have to go to therapy like every day instead of once a week.
Group. We should start having progressive group.
Yeah, thank you. So
live-in therapists come live at my house and we'll have group daily.
Commune.
Yes.
Gosh, I love it. Anyway, on that note, we're going to take off. Sarah, come join us whenever you fancy. And I know we're going to be seeing you next week. So
yes.
Yeah, I'm coming to see Joe Biden in Denver.
Yay! I know. We'll see you on Saturday.
Yeah.
Yay!
Yay! All right.
Well, thank you again. Check out Sarah on Twitter, at Sarah Burris, right? Did I get that right?
Yep, that's right.
At rawstory.com, of course. You can find us on Twitter, at Irreverent Duo, reverenttestimony@gmail.com. And, yeah, thanks for tuning in. Stay active, stay tuned, stay involved. And we'll talk to you next week.